Okay, well, thank you all for coming. Everything I'm talking about is an investigation for me. So I guess I must be an expert because they hired me to fly out here and speak about it. But when we talk about really, you know, not just heal the human condition, but helping people evolve beyond relationship to their wounds, beyond relationship to their trauma, to a greater wholeness that's inspired not just by the motive to heal, but the motive to actually evolve, the motive to become something more, to go further. You know, it takes everything as healers. It takes everything we've got, and it's an inquiry. None of it's nailed down. So I've been thinking about this a long time. I went pretty unbiased into clinical practice, and what I'm presenting here this weekend is just what my own clinical experience has impressed upon me. So in 1995, I wrote a series of three articles called Betrayal of Intimacy in Chinese Medicine. My two books go very much further than those articles did at the time. The Chinese wouldn't have ever talked about any of this stuff, so you're never... The people who wrote the classics of Chinese medicine never met a woman who wasn't property. So they never would have spoken about any of this. And still today, you'd be hard-pressed to find a traditional Chinese man or woman who would talk about any of this in a medical clinic. You'd be very hard-pressed due to the culture. One, because in China, it's state-run medicine, and so it's the state that's listening to you when you're receiving medical treatment. And two, because it just isn't Confucian to talk about these things. And three, because the capacity to introspect in the way that everybody here takes introspection for granted didn't really emerge in the human race until the last 100 years. So it might occur to some of you that your grandparents didn't really introspect. Now, if you're in your 20s, that's probably not true. If your grandparents are boomers, which is conceivably could happen at this point, that isn't true. But if your grandparents were the generation that fought World War II, they didn't introspect. If you ask my grandmother what she was feeling, if you noticed when she was upset, she just burst into tears. And if you ask my grandfather, what are you feeling, you might as well have be speaking Swahili to him. He would have just stared at you. This cup would give you a more profound answer if you listen closely enough. So the capacity to introspect in the way that we do is a fairly new emergence. Human beings tend to look at themselves and then look back in history and project who they are, thinking people were always that way. When the Chinese looked at what we can, when we look inside and we see ourselves, the Chinese saw spirits. The Hun, the three Hun, the seven Po, wasn't the self. There were things that came, that incarnated into you, and when you died, they left. And they all went to different places. There wasn't any unified sense of an individual soul, right? There was the Hun, the three Hun, seven Po, the Ling, the Shen, all things that came from one place or another and went back to one place or another. So all this is to say that this is the first time I'm ever giving this class. So I wouldn't want to say that it's a beta test because the material's pretty refined. But it is the first time I'm giving this course in this format. So I'm excited to do that. And we certainly, if anybody has any input from their own experience or their own understanding of Chinese medicine, please feel free. We can have a conversation about it. Again, I don't think any of this is nailed down. You know, when it comes to issues of trust and intimacy, we're just getting started. If you took all the books on trust and intimacy out of a New Age bookshop, you'd only have maps left. You wouldn't even have the cooking books, right? So you'd only have like maps to Seattle left. So people have written a lot about it, but I just want to say I think, you know, it's an infinite frontier. You know, the human mind, the heart, the soul, it's an infinite frontier. So we're all just explorers in this, and to any degree I'm ahead of you guys in it. By virtue of having practiced full-time for 30 years, I could only be a little bit ahead in the grand scheme of things. So, he's testing out the microphone. Do we have ignition?
Quickest way to do it is just pull it forward.
Thank you very much.
It's a brand new one since that thing was missing.
Good.
Try to set it from the other end.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so do I have a volume control here? Oh, okay. Okay, there we go. A little lower, please. A little lower. Maybe just a little higher. Hello. There. Is that okay?
Great. There are 4 sets of batteries.
Thank you, sir. Good luck with your knee.
Thank you. Enjoy the day.
Take good care of it. Take Chinese herbs and get acupuncture.
I have.
Good. Okay. So, we're going to be looking... The course is going to consist of two parts. The first thing I'm going to do is create a hopefully very large philosophical context. And then the second part of the class is we're going to go over a lot of protocols in terms of acupuncture, herbs, thinking about acupuncture points, practical things to do. I'm not going to be treating anyone. It's not that kind of course. What good would it do? Put a needle, say, see they're healed. It's not the same as when we're dealing with somebody's knee or their shoulder. So having been in practice 30 years, I mean, look, people are really suffering. People are really suffering. There's enough suffering to go around. And in our demographic, the single largest cause of people suffering is their own self. Okay, so some terrible things have happened to people, don't get me wrong. I mean, rape, incest, divorce, people have been to war. There's plenty of post-traumatic stress, plenty of suffering to go around. Some terrible things have happened to people. But in our demographic, look, I mean, probably no one in this room was raised in Bosnia. No one in this room has lived a life like the people in Syria are living now, right? So even though some terrible things have probably happened to people, we still have more choice and opportunity than any demographic of any people who've ever lived. The outcome of our lives, when all is said and done at the end of our life, the way our life looked is going to be more the result of the choices that we've freely made than any other people who've lived prior to us in history. And more so for the people in this room than 85% of the world has today. I mean, you know, the women in a significant part of the world are still owned. In a very significant part of the world, still owned. Right? So if they're owned, the men aren't free either. Right? So if they're owned, the men aren't free either. That's 85% of the world. So we have the, you know, to have the freedom to come to spend 2 days in a class like this, because you want to, is more freedom than the Emperor of China had. It's more freedom than the pharaohs had, or the kings had. We have more options, right? Like tonight for dinner, we could go to Northern Italian, Southern Italian, Northern Indian, Southern Indian, Swedish. We could probably find a Mongolian restaurant, an Ethiopian restaurant, right? Well, the pharaoh couldn't say, let's go out for some, you know, Mongolian tonight. You want to go to that new Northern Italian restaurant? Which of the 900 sushi bars would you like to go to? We have a lot of options. So, a conclusion that I've drawn a couple conclusions after working all these years. One conclusion is It's not what happens to a person so much, but their relationship to it. So it's not what happens to a person that's the most significant thing, it's their relationship to it. And the second thing that has occurred to me is that no matter how serious and unfortunate a person's experience has been in terms of wounding or trauma, their history, whatever it may be, is never as compelling as their future potential. Right? So no matter how wounded, no matter how heartbroken, no matter how egregious, no matter how bad the history is, there is always a spirit and a soul, an intelligence, a consciousness waiting to fully live and move forward right now and drop a victimized relationship to the past. And that is never not possible to do. It is never not possible to drop a victimized relationship to one's past in any moment. There's never anything in the way. And at least in a demographic as fortunate as we are, there are no excuses. Right? At least in our demographic, there's no excuses. So when I say our demographic, I'm pointing to the people in this room, the people who attend Bastyr. I'm talking about the culture of healers. Because the culture of healers has to make this leap first before we can expect the culture of patients to make it. You see? So there's a moment in a person's life when they start to get serious about coming to the end of seeking. So we all know a lot of seekers, right? We all know a lot of seekers. We all know a lot of people who aren't seekers, right? So only a small percentage of people are seekers, right? In the medical context, seeking means authentically wanting to heal. Authentically wanting to heal and being really interested in what it takes to do it. So we all know a lot of seekers, but how many finders do we know? How many people who've come to the end of seeking? So if somebody's seeking for 10 years, you say that person is serious. And if someone's seeking for 20 years, you say they're not giving up. And if someone's seeking for 30 years, you start to get suspicious. And if someone's seeking for 40 years, you have to draw the conclusion that they just like taking workshops. That they're not actually, because by 40, there are enough resources, and the quality varies, there are enough authentic teachers out there that if one was really serious, one could come to the end of seeking potentially fairly quickly, because it actually doesn't take time to come to the end of seeking once you're really deadly serious about coming to the end of seeking. When you're not deadly serious, if it's just entertainment or kind of interesting or spiritual entertainment, then it could take a lifetime or it could take 100,000 lifetimes, right? You go to Umalina Day Spa and have your choice of scents and they spray the lavender over you or the patchouli and lay you down and put the hot chocolate on your face and rub your feet. And under the auspices of healing, you could say, I could get used to this. This healing stuff is great, but then you're never going to come to the end of healing because all the ayahuasca and tantric sex and psychotherapy and can be a lot of fun. It can be very entertaining. All the bongo drumming and, right? You see, it can get very entertaining. So there are a lot of things out there in the marketplace that can take a lot of time, but they don't necessarily bring us to the end of seeking to make that shift, to make that leap beyond identification with the wounded, traumatized, victimized, hurt, and damaged part of the self. So we want to spend some time, and we will spend some time in this class looking at that leap and the nature of that leap and what that leap is. I think it's simply my experience that there is a wounded, traumatized, victimized part of us in all of us. And for anybody, everybody's pain, and another thing I've discovered is everybody's pain is just as real to them. The person who's dying of ovarian cancer, the 32-year-old mother who's dying of ovarian cancer, who has two little kids, her pain is as real to her as the person whose elbow hurts really badly and they can't play tennis this summer, so they have to drop out of the league. Do you see? Everybody's pain. If you're burnt on 80% of your body, or you just pick up a hot frying pan and get a burn on your hand, the amount of pain you're feeling in any moment is like all the pain in the world. So if you take all your consciousness and fit it into the one little burn on your finger, that's going to be your entire reality. Do you understand? So people are conditioned by genetics and by culture to focus with and focus on and identify with the wounded, hurt, traumatized, and victimized part of the self. And when that part of the self occupies one's entire self-identification, then it's one's whole reality. And then one is acting out of that. One is acting out of that in the world, creating their karma. So there's a part of the self which loves healing, but has no intention of ever being healed. And then there's a part of the self that is fine right now and doesn't need healing and could never relate to it because nothing ever happened there. And having a philosophical view like this, an overarching philosophical view, this is the foundation, it's the bedrock of being able to relate to people. It's not all just about stick needles here, stick needles there, give this herb, give that herb. It's very important to have this broad philosophical overview, but it's not enough for it to be merely a philosophical overview. It has to be true in one's own experience. It has to be true in one's own experience. And what I have noticed, now this is generally true in culture. It's generally true in culture, but I think it's particularly egregious in people who are in healing professions. What I've noticed is that most people have a very intellectually abstract relationship to the different dimensions of their own self. They have a very abstract... Some people have read philosophy and then can talk about, well, you know, of course Descartes said this and Nietzsche said this and Confucian said this and the Nei Ching says this about the Hun and the Po and blah, 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 blah. But it's all very academic and they don't really transmit a very... deeply lived relationship to all the dimensions of the self. It's all sort of like the inner self is just a soup of competing motivations. And sometimes they're identified with these motivations and sometimes they're identified with those motivations and it's just not clear. So we're going to take quite a considerable amount of time, or let's say just reasonably enough time today, to talk about the different dimensions of who we are as human beings. Because the question is, when a person is wounded, traumatized, victimized, when a person is suffering, the question has to be, who is suffering? Who is suffering? Because there is a self that is not suffering, and the self that is not suffering wasn't born, isn't going to die, is purely positive, and was never wounded, traumatized, victimized, injured, or hurt, because nothing ever happened there, nothing is happening there, and nothing ever could happen there. And this dimension of the self is not really taught in public school. And when it is taught in traditional schools, meaning, you know, churches and synagogues and mosques, it's taught in a lot of superstitious and mythic terms that as postmodern people we often have a hard time understanding. It can be hard to relate to, right? Notions like people walk on water, virgins give birth to children, Lao Tzu, when he died, ascended to heaven on the back of a crane. Many of us can only relate to those as metaphors, beautiful teaching metaphors. We can relate to them as myths with an essence, that a philosophical essence that demonstrates principles that we can look more deeply into. But as actual facts, it's sort of hard to relate to a lot of these stories for many of us, right? And it seems to me egregious that people would graduate from acupuncture schools and homeopathy schools and other healing schools and not have spent significant amount of time to really inquire into what is the soul, what is the spirit, what is emptiness, what is conscience, what is the authentic self, what is the ego, and to have a really lived experience of that, because we're only going to be able to understand others to no more than we're going to understand ourselves. So a great strength of Chinese medicine, a great strength of Chinese medicine is its ability to formulate a unique diagnosis for every individual, to differentiate and come up with a unique diagnosis for every individual. Now, that's fantastic. That's a great strength. There's no problem. But we tend to ignore the universal dimensions of human experience that are just working within all of us all the time. We're much more similar to each other. Much more similar than we are different. So when I first started my clinical practice, I was fascinated by everybody's unique story. And it was all so interesting. And within about a year and a half, I was like, I get it. There's only one thing going on here. There's only one patient coming for treatment. The only difference are the names, the dates, the places. For the most part. And on the other hand, you know, just when I think I've seen everything, life has a way of surprising me. But there are some universal forces at work. On a thermodynamic level, everybody can understand that when there's stagnation, the body tries to move stagnation to the degree it has qi and yang. And if it can't move the stagnation, that creates friction, and the friction generates heat, and the heat over time consumes fluid. Right? And then a person, it leads to dryness and yin deficiency if it's not corrected over a long time. So I think we'd all understand that. Well, that's impersonal, right? Just, it's physics. It just happens to everyone. It's like gravity. It's the same thing keeping me in my chair that's keeping you in your chair. The fact that you're not floating up doesn't mean anything about you. Right? It's just an impersonal force. And I would like to look at the impersonal forces that work on human beings and that work within us, and look at the inner landscape a little bit, because we have to know who we're treating. And the thing is that we're not going to be able to take anyone any further than we go ourselves. You don't have to have had MS to treat somebody with MS. You don't ever have to have had sciatica to effectively treat sciatica. You can never have had sciatica. Give a person one needle, their sciatica can be gone. But when it comes to engendering wholeness and laying the framework for a person to shift their fundamental identification in life away from the part of the self that has been wounded and traumatized and deeply hurt, and to awaken to the dimensions of the self that are purely positive, We're not going to do that in an individual to any degree more than we've done it ourselves. It is true that we can engender higher state experiences in people without having been there. Needle windows of the sky, whatever, you know, give people blood-moving herbs or herbs that affect Shen in some way. And people might have higher state experiences. But when it comes to abstracting the meaning from the experience, learning from the experience, feeling implicated by the experience, changing one's life into relationship, changing one's life in relationship to the experience to find depth in it, to create a new self, that's not going to happen to any degree more than we've done it. So we're going to spend some time this morning talking about these different dimensions of the self. I will say that the last 100 years in the West, self-knowledge has been governed most significantly by the psychological paradigm founded by William James and Freud in the late 1800s. So at the leading edge of culture, that means people who are in a post-traditional form of consciousness. People who are in a traditional form of consciousness, their relationship to their interior dimension would culturally relate more to what the Bible says, what the Old Testament says, what the New Testament says, what the Quran says, what the Confucian text says. Do you understand? People who are in a traditional form, truly, authentically in a traditional form of consciousness. People in a post-traditional form of consciousness, the way we think about it, so that means postmodern, baby boomer onward, right? So modern would, so traditional would be the great traditions. Modern would be Mad Men level of development on TV, right? So that'd be like Frank Sinatra, the Rat Pack, martinis. Everyone know what I'm talking about? Airline hostesses from the 60s. That kind of, no? Have you ever been to Florence, Italy? You ever been to Italy? Spain? You ever been to a working class city in America? So you go to Florence and the 4-year-old girls and the 90-year-old women are all wearing stockings and 3-inch heels. And the guys stand out on the street at night and the women walk by and the guys go, "Hey baby, wanna get a drink with me?" And the women pretend to be insulted but love it. The women would be more insulted if the guys didn't do that. Like, that's a modern level of development. So postmodern would be 1960s onward. A pluralist, able to hold many points of view simultaneously. So rather than thinking, you know, my God and everyone else is the evil other, a pluralist would say, well, Buddhism has something to teach us and the Muslim religion has something to teach us. Rumi has something to teach us. Lao Tzu has something to teach us. Confucius had something to teach us, right? All these different points of view, and I can hold them all simultaneously, and it doesn't freak me out. I can hold many points of view. You have your truth, I have my truth, right? Everybody has a relative point of view. So we hold them. So that would be postmodern. I'm not sure exactly why I was talking about that. Anyone want to remind me? Anyway, people come in with all different levels of development, and we have to be able to understand them. So I was saying people at a postmodern level of development, which is probably most of the people in this room, if probably all, people at a postmodern level of development, the largest single input into how we look at ourselves is psychologically. So for the last 50 years, what's been called spiritual in our culture has been really conflated with psychology. right? Psychology and yoga, psychology and this, psychology and that. Books, you find the psychology of yoga, the psychology of martial arts, this, everything's psychology. And I prefer to look at things from a spiritual point of view than a psychological point of view. So we'll have to differentiate that. But when I say a spiritual point of view, I don't necessarily want to go, I don't mean Judaism and Catholicism and the Muslim religion and Buddhism and Hinduism. I don't mean any of the traditions. I'm talking about what would be a post-traditional spiritual perspective on it. So I'm going to be speaking through that lens this weekend. So the question then is, who is injured? Who was injured? The person comes into you, the individual is suffering. We want to ask, who is suffering? There are different dimensions of the self. There are absolute dimensions of the self, and there are relative dimensions of the self. The absolute dimensions are the dimensions that we all share with each other. In other words, when you're one with the universe, one is absolute, right? So when you're one with whatever put you here, and I'm one with whatever put me here, we'd have to be one with the same thing. Right? We'd have to be one with the same thing, so that would be absolute. So there are absolute dimensions of the self and there are relative dimensions of the self. The relative dimensions of the self would be personality, the ego, likely the soul. So we're going to talk about the absolute and relative dimensions of the self. I want to just, the second I stood up, I said to myself, you're going to pull the thing off the table. But it was too late. There was a gap there between perception and action. And I knew it was going to hit before it even hit the ground. Fortunately, no harm was done. I want to talk a little bit about Chinese physiology and how we got here. We're going to go through this quickly. In other classes, I spend a lot more time on it. So I just want to look this is a little abstract, but I think it's a simple model. You should have been given this in a handout. So behind that article, there should be two other pieces of paper, I'm hoping. Yes. So I'm going to draw that physiology chart, not the five-element chart. You have this five-element chart here that I gave you, and you can, if you want to memorize the five-element points, for anyone who cares, you can just photocopy that and just keep writing the numbers in until you can draw the whole chart from memory, and just write the G-clef points next to it, and the low points, and then you'll have the whole thing, and I thought I'd just give you that. So we're just going over the other diagram, so you don't have to draw it. So who are we? How did we get here? We have to ask, who is the human being? What good would it do to just say, do these points, do those points, do that points? For me, who is a human being? How did we get here? To me, Chinese medicine is a science that places consciousness, places consciousness itself and the consciousness of the individual who is your patient in a physiological, cultural, and cosmological context. The five-element chart is a map. If you take that five-element chart and you were to put a dot, directly at the center, the dot would read, you are here. And then this is the wheel of samsara. It's the Sheng cycle. And the Chinese for samsara is shengse, birth, death. And this is the Sheng cycle. Birth, death. Birth, death. Okay? So the illusion is that we're out here. That's the illusion. This is a cycle of conditioned weather, thought, and feeling. And the illusion becomes that we're out here in this movie, but we're always just the consciousness watching it. We're always just the consciousness. We're always aware of what's going on out here. But in time, we come to identify with it, and we think we're out here. But if one can wake up and clearly see, oh, thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensation, weather, the events of my life are all objects that I'm aware of. I am the consciousness that's aware of them. And the consciousness that's aware of them is infinite. It's not located in time and space. It's infinite. And I am that. That would be the traditional awakening, Eastern awakening, expressed by Ramana Maharshi, for instance. Thou art that. I am that. So you are here. Put it more in the center. Okay. So Chinese medicine is a science that contextualizes consciousness in relationship to, if you think of these 60 element points, that's the relationship between the one and the many. And Chinese science is creating a context for understanding of the relationship between the self. There is a self, there is a consciousness in your patient, a consciousness with an identification to its life events, and that consciousness thinks it's out here. When it was spring, this happened to me. When it was summer, this happened to me. My relationship with my mother was this. My relationship with my father was that. I'm afraid of this. I love that. I get angry about this. And it's identified with all these thoughts, feelings, and sensations out here. We've put consciousness, we've mapped it out in relationship to thoughts, feelings, emotions, and weather. So Chinese medicine creates the context for understanding consciousness in relationship to physiology, the biosphere, culture, and cosmos. So who is the individual? Who is the individual coming into us? From my point of view, there is consciousness, and there is only one consciousness in the universe. So to the degree I understand who I am, the degree I'm clear about all the forces and motivations within myself, I know they're no different for anyone else. There's an illusion that they're different, but I know that they're not. So to know, Sun Tzu in The Art of War would have said, to know the enemy, know yourself. And I would just say, to know your patient, you have to know yourself. Universal forces at work. We learn in school so much about how to diagnose the individual, but there's so much more going on. From a certain perspective, the individual is an illusion. And what I really want to spend some time on are these very broad movements that are true for all of us. And as healers, it's most important that we wake up to this within ourselves. From my point of view, technique and knowledge, as important as they are, and they're endless in Chinese medicine, right? Technique and knowledge are endless. I mean, I've been in Chinese medicine for 36 years. I've been practicing 30 years full time. And I just feel like I'm getting started. I look forward to retiring in 4 years so I can actually learn this stuff. And as much as I know about what I know, I never know what I don't know. And there are huge vistas, like in terms of what Jeffrey Yuen would know, or Richard Tan, or the names go on. And I wouldn't know even what some of you know, because you have your own experience and you studied your own thing. So you have your own synthesis. So it really is infinite. So ultimately, when we discover who and what we really are, words can point to it, but can't ever perfectly capture it. Words can point to it. You can get transmission through words and have an aha moment and wake up. So words aren't insignificant, but they can never approach the real awakening with absolute fidelity. They can never convey it perfectly well. So Lao Tzu recognizes this, and he says the name that can be named is not the eternal name. Right? The Tao that can be spoken of is not the eternal Tao. So the eternal Tao is like everything down here, and we can't talk about it. It's a mystery. So on acupuncturists on Facebook, they're trying to sort it out, but I'm not optimistic. So as far as we ever get in reading the classics or in meditation, even if we have a tremendous amount of spiritual experience and intellectual experience and lead a very full, vibrant life of sincere and authentic inquiry, we can intuit this infinite mystery just beyond the limits of our knowledge. And that's always going to be true no matter how far our knowledge goes. So I think it's, you know, humility is good, and it's important to approach all this with an open heart and open mind. So the mystery is here. And Lao Tzu says, well, you know, Lao Tzu is going to die. He's on the back of a donkey going toward the Western Pass. The Western Pass is the name of CV1, right? Jinmen, Golden Gate. Golden Gate. So Golden Gate is the orifice you come out of when you're born, and it's the portal you go back through when you die. Right? So as an image of something coming from nothing, the child comes out of this infinite emptiness of the mother's womb, the womb of Tao, into life. But when we die, metaphorically, we're going back through that gate into an infinite void. Something's coming from nothing. And the gatekeeper tells Lao Tzu, you can't die yet. You have to fulfill your destiny by writing a book of your acquired knowledge. And that's the Tao Te Ching. And he starts and he says, okay, but what I need to talk about doesn't have a name. And anything I name won't be it. But since you're making me do this, I'm forced to give it a name. And I call it Tao. And the Tao is one. But now we have two things. We have the named Tao and the unnamed Tao. So we have two things. We have heaven and we have earth. So now we have the uterus and the ovaries. And the uterus and the ovaries are incubating a fetus. And what is it that incubates? It's chi. And the character for this kind of chi is three drops of water and an arrow in the center of a target, Zhang Qi, the Qi of the center. It's like, that could be Zheng, like Zhengguo, like China, the middle country. But we put three drops of water next to it, and it depicts a vast whirlpool with emptiness at the center. And it also depicts a geyser exploding up. So the geyser exploding up is the Big Bang. That gives us the image of something coming from nothing. So the function of qi is to circulate. Qi allows me, doing qigong, I can hold heaven and earth apart and keep them separate. But the function of qi is also to blend things. So at the level of the heart, I bring yin and yang, heaven and earth, back together. So qi is keeping the two poles of heaven and earth distinct. And qi is also blending them so the two are just one thing. And then it's warming, and it's transforming, and it's moving. So all those functions are here, which is incubation. Chuang Tzu says these three things, heaven, earth, and qi, remain together forever as one unity. So the mother and the what will be the child, the imminent potential of the child, which is the universe to manifest, are still one at this point. They haven't been severed. So if we bring this into a physiological context, the one is Jing. So the unnamed Tao is the infinite ocean of potential out of which all things come. The Tao is the infinite ocean of potential out of which all things come. And the Jing is the infinite ocean of potential within us that connects us to emptiness at its root, one, one, one. connects us to emptiness at its root and is the infinite ocean of potential out of which all our capacities come. Right? So if you're very good in one person's very good in music and one has a capacity for math and one for dance and one for clarity of insight and another person for deductive reasoning, whatever, those capacities are all in Jing. So anything we can be is in there. It's that infinite ocean of potential out of which all the cells in the body come, and the arms eventually, the eight extra meridians, right, come as an edifice embryologically for the arms and the legs to form around and to define the center. So if there's one, there must be two. And we have corresponding to the right kidney in heaven, we have the right kidney corresponding to heaven. And this is yuan, as in yuan qi. That's yang. And then on the left, we have the left kidney corresponding to earth, which is the foundation of yin. And then between the two, we have a furnace. And that furnace is ming men. Oh, geez, drawing it backwards. I'm dyslexic even in Chinese. Ming men. Gate of destiny. So Ming Men is infusing yin with yang, and out of the kidney arises the shen. So Ming Men is this furnace infusing primordial yin with primordial yang and jing with shen. And so what we have here is jing, qi, and shen. We have one, two, three, and we have one, two, three. 3 times 3 is 9. That's the number of completion. So in 9 months, the fetus is born. And at the moment of birth, the first breath is drawn. And at the moment of first breath, life is streaming in from the outside. So everything to the left of that line are the three treasures. It's called early heaven, anterior heaven. It's everything you get in life as a foundation between the moment sperm hits egg and the first breath. So it's all your innate, your inherited, your constitutional strengths and weaknesses are all gleaned at this moment. Understood? At the moment of conception, and they develop to the first breath, and from the first breath on, life comes streaming in, and we gain life through our eyes. So we have bladder one, through our ears, small intestine 19. Large intestine 20. Stomach 1. Gallbladder 1. And triple heater 22. Okay, so we've got colon to stomach, small intestine to bladder, 3 heater to gallbladder. Okay. So, there are 7 holes in the head, and all the entry-exit points for the yang organs. Everyone know what exit and entry points are? We'll be talking about them at length. Do you not know, Rachel? Do you know? Everyone knows. Okay, good. So, the entry-exit points over the heart all bring qi and blood through the heart. They're for the yin organs. And the entry-exit points on the head bring qi and blood through the mind. And those are for the yang organs. So at the moment of first breath, we take our first breath. The eyes are picking up light. The nose can smell. The ears can hear. And life starts to be transmitted internally. So Ming Men is fusing yin with yang, shen with jing. And what's called later heaven or posterior heaven We can just call it acquired experience. This is inherited. Everything on this side of the line is acquired. So Mingmen is this furnace that is infusing our acquired experience with our internal experience. Okay. And as long as the food we eat and the water we breathe and the water we drink and the air we breathe and the food we eat and the thoughts we think correspond to reality, then we're feeding purity in here. And Mingmen is going to combine yin with yang and shen with jing and external with internal in a way there's just one thing happening. And there's perfect fidelity. And these will remain, shen and jing, yin and yang will remain as one, with perfect confluence with heaven and earth, having perfect, that duality of heaven and earth, having perfect fidelity to the Tao as one, having perfect fidelity to the unnamed mystery. And all those relationships will be retained, and there'll be physiological integrity. So this is the philosophical, theoretical ideal, and if that were to happen, you wouldn't be able to do an eight principle or five element diagnosis on anyone. Because everyone would have five elements in a perfect circle. None would stand out. And there'd be nothing internal relative to external, hot relative to cold, fast relative to slow, yin relative to yang. There'd just be one. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Because we live in a relative universe, right? And everybody has tendencies. So, and we have no clean air left on the planet, and we have no clean water left on the planet, and all the food's genetically modified. There's no organic certifiable corn left on the planet, right? And we think, it's not just that we think impure thoughts, we pay attention to impure thoughts. And I will just note that many people will defend to the death principles that they've read in books or been taught by teachers that they don't actually even believe in. They wouldn't even know if they believed in it because they've never subjected them to scrutiny. So the outcome of most people's lives seems to be determined in large part by forces they're unaware of or don't understand, in very large part. We would like that to not be the case. So we would like, in terms of overcoming trauma, we don't want, and wounding, we could define wounding and trauma. Look, practically speaking, some very bad things have happened to people. And you never know how far anything can go in terms of healing and overcoming it. But as healers, we should have a position of no inherent sense of limitation in relationship to how far anyone can go. No inherent sense of limitation. Sky is the limit. Hubble telescope shows us the sky isn't even the limit. Sky is the limit would just be a modern term. For postmodern and beyond, if you start to ponder, well, what is the limit? And then you start thinking in terms of the Hubble telescope, your mind just gets blown instantly and you say, well, there could be no limit. There is no limit. So we should have no inherent sense of limitation. We don't want to be arrogant. So look, some people have suffered so much that maybe they won't really transcend it in this lifetime. But won't doesn't mean can't. Won't and can't aren't the same thing. So certainly as a healer, I never want to have any inherent sense of limitation about what's possible for a person. And my experience is that because I authentically don't have that sense of limitation, that itself will be inspiring enough to people to help them achieve something beyond what they can conceive of for themselves. Healing even from the worst things isn't as difficult as the ego would like it to be. So, ideally we'd have the sense of unity maintained, but there is a filter through which all incoming information is going, and that filter is the human mind. Okay? So there's a screen here. Practically speaking, I didn't really finish my thought. Practically speaking, in terms of treating people to really help them transcend their wounds, we have to have no inherent sense of limitation. And the best that we can possibly do is help an individual take responsibility for everything in relationship to their suffering that they are actually responsible for. It would be unreasonable to ask people to take responsibility for dimensions of their suffering that they weren't responsible for. But minimally, what we, you know, well, minimally and maximally, I think it's reasonable that we want to remove the patient to every degree possible as an input to the source of their own suffering. So to whatever degree the patient is perpetuating their own suffering, we want to remove that as a source of input. There might be other sources that they're not responsible for, but we want them to take responsibility for what they are. And in my experience, it turns out that we're most significantly responsible for our own suffering. That if we can truly remove ourselves as a source of input into our own suffering, that regardless of any other dimensions that might be left to our suffering, we will be able to, we'll find the dignity and the compassion for others to be able to bear our suffering in a way that is liberating to other people, to whatever degree that suffering is left. So, we want to get people out of the way. So, between our perception of life and the Jing, Qi, and Shen arising within us as the foundation, the unsullied, unconditioned dimension of the self, there is a filter. That filter's like a windshield, and it has all kinds of conditioning on it. So you're driving a car down the road, and in time bugs hit it, and birds poop on it, and you might hit a deer. Bald eagle might even poop on it, right? Glass might hit it, rocks getting kicked up from the cars in front of you. In time, the windshield becomes covered with gunk. And it seems to be the nature of things that people begin to go down that road so long staring at that windshield, they start to think they are the windshield. They start to get identified with all the garbage on it. They think they are in the movie. They think they are out here. They lose, the infant is living here. The Tao Te Ching says it can cry all day without getting hoarse. Fierce beasts will not attack it, wasps will not sting it. Such is the perfection of its Jing. Such is the fullness of its Jing. Now the infant is doing that, but the infant doesn't know it's doing it. Infants are spontaneous, but for the mothers and fathers here, infants are spontaneously what? Spontaneously selfish. Feed me, hold me, play with me. I want this, I want that. And when you give them what they want, then they stop creating a problem. But they're totally self-centered. So the evolution is away from self toward an understanding that there's something bigger in the picture than just oneself. And we have plenty of historical examples to understand that the way out of one's own dilemma is always, the fast track out of one's own dilemma of suffering, the immediate fast track out of that hell, that self-created hell, self-indulgence in our wounds and traumas, is a care for something greater than our own selves. And the more we care for something greater than our own self, the more the self that is wounded and traumatized will fall into the background. And that doesn't have to take a lot of time. It's just that we need to, you know, we want to have this care for something of, you know, how great can care for something of oneself extend? How far can it extend? Well, ultimately it can extend to a universal proportion. One could feel responsible to the universe, to the ongoing process of cosmic development, right? That would be the largest context. And we certainly have plenty of examples of people who cared for something more than themselves. Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, Christopher Reeves, Susan B. Anthony. You know, the list goes on and on and on. Right? Gloria Steinem would be another. The list, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who chained herself to the White House fence and was tortured in prison to get women the right to vote in 1921. So we can all see that it's really a care for something greater than our own wounds and traumas, a care for something bigger that can allow us to bear those wounds and traumas for the sake of something greater. So we have this filter between our perception and our true self. And that filter is mind, and it's relative. You have your mind, I have my mind, true. Everyone in here has a different mind, but my mind works exactly the way there's no difference in the way anybody's mind works in here. Now, there are psychological differences. Aren't there psychological differences generically between men and women? Aren't there psychological differences between Jews and Catholics? There are psychological differences. There are relative differences, right? And everyone in here has a unique story, and right? So that would be the relative dimension of the self, but there are also universal dimensions of the self. There are two kinds of conditioning on this lens, on this filter. There's genetic conditioning, which is also karmic. So when we say genetic in the West, we mean physical transmission from ancestry. But when we say karmic, karmic transmission includes physical transmission, but it would also be non-physical transmission from ancestry. If you want to say energetic transmission, I guess that would be fine with me. I'm not a big fan of the word energy. But if you want to say energetic transmission, I think we'd all understand in the context of, the culture we share as healers, what that means. So that's non-physical transmission. The problem with energy is you can measure energy, so it's still physical. Use the term energy in physics, you can hook an oscilloscope up or do the math and figure out how much energy is in a system. So when we use the term energy, we tend to mean something non-physical, but the problem with the word is in the West it has, you know, E equals MC squared, that's a mathematical equation. So that's been worked out. There's not a mystery in it. When we use the term energy, there's also always a dimension of the unknown, foundation of all things in the term energy. So we can have genetic conditioning here, karmic conditioning. Karmic conditioning would be five-element constitutional type. So there'd be a constitutional tint on the window so that water constitutions would relate to life experience in terms of cold, in terms of fear, in terms of contraction, in terms of will, in terms of power. They'd see everything through a blue lens. A wood constitutional type would relate to things in terms of decision making, choices, plans, aggression, self-esteem, perspective, anger, belligerence, benevolence, humility. a different set of associations. So that would be true for each of the five elements. Would be, so for the wood type, it's green. For the red fire type, it's red. For the earth type, it's yellow. For the metal type, it's white. Different constitutional conditioning. Other kinds of constitutional conditioning would be female conditioning, male conditioning, right? Female and male conditioning. There's ethnic conditioning. So all kinds of religious conditioning, right? So there's cultural conditioning. This cultural conditioning on this lens, not just genetic conditioning, but acquired culture that you were raised in, right? That is different. Are people here, I don't live around here, but are you different? Are you aware of the difference between people from like who live in Bothell and Kirkland and what's this place, Kenmore? Is there a difference between people? No? Well, I'm from New York, so in New York, if you were talking about someone and you said they're from Jersey, they're from Brooklyn, they're from the uptown, they're from downtown, they're from the East Village, they're from the West Village, they're from Westchester, they're from Long Island. People who live in Brooklyn don't think they're from Long Island. But if you fly a plane over Brooklyn, you will see from 30,000 feet that in fact Brooklyn is Long Island. But anybody who lives in Brooklyn will say, I'm not from Long Island. When I go to teach in Germany, when the Northern Germans have lunch with me, they make fun of the Southern Germans. And when the Southern Germans have lunch with me, they make fun of the Northern Germans. I'm Jewish, so to me, you're just Germans. So I don't get all the distinctions. But these kind of cultural distinctions are real. So there are different... So probably around here you would know the difference between people from different places. You'd be able to probably think about it. So that doesn't mean that you can prejudge a person because they have this skin color or that ethnicity or this religion. But there is a background that you can judge the person against. The question would be, is how a person is behaving, and to what degree is it an unconscious reflection of their culture? To what degree are they expressing something that transcends that culture? That's what's interesting. To what degree is this person just an unconscious reflection of culture? To what degree are they a radical force for change in their culture? You see, that's always the interesting question. That radical force for change being expressed in any culture is always spirit manifesting. So spirit isn't just this warm, fuzzy thing you get when you're doing drumming nights and chanting Om. Spirit is what tears culture to pieces. Right? It's revolutionary. Brought down the Roman Empire. Right? Buddha was a prince who walked away from his only son. Do you know what having a son meant to kings historically? His wife gave birth and Buddha went to the door and said, before I go off to live my enlightenment in the world, I want to see my son's face for the once. And he walked to the door and didn't open it and turned his back and said, it'll create too much attachment. And he turned his entire back on the kingdom and on the monarchy. So that's a very radical thing in Eastern culture at the time. So spirit is what moved Martin Luther King and Gandhi. And so spirit is also this radical revolutionary force. The junk on the windshield is what stops it from shining. So in terms of wounds and trauma, that junk on the windshield is a self-concept, a self-image that is identified with the wounds and trauma, so the individual comes to know themselves as the wound. At the deepest core, at the deepest source of self, when the person looks as deep as they can through the postmodern view, they find a core wounding. Don't you know how traumatic the birth experience is? Right? Isn't there a lot written about that? Birth trauma. Trauma in your last lives. I once had a patient tell me that the reason he had just had a stroke was because 250,000 years ago in Atlantis he had cheated on his wife. Now, this person, when he had his stroke, was in the unfortunate circumstance of being in his hospital room on life support, and both his families showed up. So he had married a woman at one end of the state and had kids with her, and also had a wife at the other end of the state and had kids with her, and they didn't know about each other and had never met. And he had been working as a physician for the state, as a veterinarian for the state, going back and forth 3 nights a week in one place, 4 nights a week in another place for 35 years. And both families showed up and met each other. So the thing is, he had a stroke not because he was leading this divided life in this life, but because 250,000 years ago in Atlantis he had cheated on his wife. There's irony there. I thought I'd point it out. So what I've discovered is that whatever anybody thinks their issue was in their last life or 100,000 lifetimes ago, it's that issue is sitting in the chair in front of you. It's what they just did. And then the mind wants it. So the person's making themselves a victim, not just of this life, but of 250,000 years of lives. But their fundamental relationship to it still is a victimized relationship to experience as an excuse for why they are the way they are. So what we want to do is we want to clean this window. So in Chinese medicine, we would say that one of the first things we would want to do, technically, is to move stagnation. Right? Isn't that one of the first things? Like if the person's not bleeding, the first thing we want to do is get stagnation moving, because if we just start tonifying, but there's stagnation, we start tonifying, it would be like putting wood in a stove where the chimney was clogged, and just keep stoking the flame. If you got stagnation, it's just going to create heat, it's going to create friction, it's going to have a meltdown, right? So we've got to move the stagnation. So I would say the single biggest source of stagnation is a person's fundamental dysfunctional identification with core wound. And generically, the problem wrong with psychotherapy is it tends to view, because psychotherapy is not spiritual, psychotherapy emerge, I mean it can be, but what we generically know is like Freudian analysis and all the therapy that came out of that emerged in culture at a time when human beings were getting disembedded from the oppression of the traditions. Right? So the psychological perspective replaced the spiritual perspective. And the psychological perspective identified a core wound at the source of self that's going to need infinite healing. How much healing? 3 sessions a week for $150 for a 50-minute hour for the rest of your life. And after 20 years, you tell your therapist, I think I'm ready to move on. The therapist is going to go, we're just getting started. Because samsara is infinite. Samsara is infinite as enlightenment is infinite. Right? They're both infinite. So consciousness, you're standing on a plank in the middle of infinite space, and to your left forever is an impure motive, and to your right forever is a pure motive. And the Chinese, so that's sort of an absolute context, and the Chinese would talk about that in terms of hexagram 23 and hexagram 24. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah. So hexagram 23 is called splitting in part. Yin and yang are separating. They're near a terminal point of separation. You have a house of cards. You have a roof but no foundation. You feel the pulse pounding superficially, but when you press on it, the whole pulse collapses. And when you have that last yang line gone, you have a corpse that has form, but nothing's moving, nothing's transforming, nothing's held together. Right? There's no chi, there's no yang left, there's no life left. Hexagram 24, you bring that yang line down to the foundation, that's kidney 7, of course, which brings breath into form, breath into form. So you renew the yang, and then you start building. through new choices and a new life, a new identification. Because now you are identified with light, with a fundamentally positive motive. And then in Taoist and Buddhist mythology, you would have a light body. You would be enlightened. You would have resolved all the karmic issues with nothing left. And there'd be pure light, pure inspiration, pure love, pure consciousness left. That would be from the traditions, right? So hexagram 23, hexagram 24. Fall equinox, winter solstice. So you can just review those hexagrams. It's all covered in my books. You can review the hexagrams. So what we want to do is we want to purify this and help shift identification. The fundamental thing that's going to heal people is a shift of identification from the wounded, traumatized, victimized self to the self where nothing ever happened. And you can treat MS without having had it. You can treat sciatica without ever having it. You can treat everything physical and all the diseases without ever having had them. But you are not going to help a person make this shift or give them any stability in that shift once it's occurred to any degree more than you've done it yourself. So from the ego's point of view, healing is great, but I have no intention of ever being healed. I love acupuncture, I love moxa, I love massages, I love doing workshops, and I'm going to keep doing them, and this is going to take a very long time. And then from the point of view of spirit, nothing ever happened, there's no problem, let's go. Let's go. You only have so many heartbeats left. You only have so many breaths left. You're here in an infinite, from our point of view, at least practically speaking, an infinite context. And in this body, even if you live 100 years, 120 years, it's going to be a blink of an eye. The rest of your life from this moment on is service. To something higher, service to something deeper. And as soon as a person wakes up to that, they go, okay, I can bear everything that happened to me. I can bear whatever I have to go through for the sake of it, for something greater. It's not about me. It's about serving something greater. And that would have to be, I think, in terms of the topic we're talking about this weekend, the fundamental shift. Who wants to go to a healer who is primarily identified with being wounded, traumatized, victimized, and needing more time to overcome it for themselves? To the degree the practitioner, see, from the ego's point of view, a patient can be 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. From the ego's point of view, whatever life I have left is already allocated to overcoming the part of life I've already lived. Whatever life I have left is already allocated to overcome whatever part of life I've already lived. And from the spirit's point of view, it's like, okay, let's go. Space shuttle's taken off. Right? So from the ego's point of view, it's like the game is already on. The coin toss happened. The kickoff happened. Right? Your team is on the field playing, and you're in the changing room doing push-ups, getting ready. So from the ego's point of view, the ego's always getting ready to be ready. I'm not ready now, I'm wounded. Someday I'll be ready. But never right now. I need more of this, more acupuncture, more herbs, more therapy, more darshans, more ayahuasca, definitely more sex, definitely more chocolate, right? So it'll happen. I know someday it'll happen, but it's not going to happen now. I'm getting ready to be ready. And from spirit's point of view, it's like spirit's just an explosion coming out of emptiness. Spirit is just it can be revealed to us that when we've let go of everything, all we are is a fire burning in infinite emptiness. That at the core of self, there's just a fire burning in infinite emptiness. And not only is that who we are, but it's who everyone is. That's where we all are. We can see that. So from spirit's point of view, it's like, let's go. Only going to be here a short time. Then we can recognize ourselves as the vehicle for the emergence of something greater more significant than our wounds and traumas and victimization, as significant as they might be.